for the most part, the returns have been low enough that there have been restrictions to the sport and the commercial fisheries.
Puzzling over low king salmon numbers in South Central. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 30th of June. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a Jamaican musher teams up with Lance Mackey for the Iditarod.
The Iditarod is probably the epitome, you know, the most famous of all sled dog races.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Go deep inside Alaska, where the unparalleled meets the unexpected. Fairbanks emanates a quality of light, energy, and warmth found nowhere else on Earth. It's the unexpected Alaska. Fairbanks, located right in your own backyard, is full of activities from the mild to the wild. Experience summer's Land of the Midnight Sun in Fairbanks. Information about attractions, travel, accommodations, and more online at explorefairbanks.com. This message sponsored by the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau.
Three state lawmakers want hearings on a bill aimed at stemming high fuel prices. Democratic Representatives Pete Peterson and Chris Tuck of Anchorage and Scott Kawasaki of Fairbanks say hearings will allow quicker action on an anti-price gouging bill that failed to advance last session. The law calls for an investigation whenever Alaska gas prices exceed the Washington state average by at least 10%. Representative Kawasaki says the bill has been unfairly characterized as price fixing.
People have said, well, this is a price fixing bill where we're actually setting a government price, and that's just not the case. What we're saying is that in the case where your gas is priced 10% higher than Washington state's average, that this investigation will open up. I don't care what the price of gas is necessarily, but I think it should be fair.
A AAA listed the average price of gas in Alaska today at $3 a gallon. That's just 12 cents over the average price in Washington. But last year, when oil prices fluctuated dramatically, the retail differential at the gas pump was well in excess of the 10% trigger in the bill. Investigations by the House Judiciary Committee and the Attorney General's office last year found no evidence of illegal collusion in the Alaska market, but did shed some light on the issue. The report largely attributed Alaska's higher gas prices to factors related to the state's limited demand. It found the state's two gas producers, Flint Hills and Tesoro, had minimal incentive to compete. Effective July 3rd, parks, highway streams, and the Little Susitna River will be closed to king salmon fishing. Disappointing king salmon runs in South Central Alaska have resulted in sport fishing closures in many a popular fishing hole. The Susitna Valley's Deshka River closed to kings earlier this month. Kodiak's Ayakulik River is closed to king sport fishing, and even Anchorage's Ship Creek closed to king anglers yesterday for the duration of the summer. Matt Miller is a regional management biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He says it's difficult to say why king salmon returns have been so low.
There's several of the systems and the returns throughout South Central that aren't producing. We're not seeing real good returns. And the short answer is we don't know. We're seeing it with the hatchery fish that we've released and are returning, and with the wild stocks, which would suggest that it's something happening out in the ocean, that it wasn't a freshwater problem, or we weren't seeing it for one specific thing. So it probably wasn't weather or a flood event or something like that related. So those indicators would suggest that it's something out in the ocean, but what that is, we don't know.
Are there other salmon species being affected? I know that at least in one Kodiak Creek, the sockeye fishing is curtailed.
It's kind of interesting. It's, as you had said, throughout South Central, we're seeing, as a general trend, fairly low productivity on the king salmon returns. Nooshigak out in Bristol Bay seems to be showing up pretty well. Not sure why that would be an exception, but that one seems to be producing pretty well so far. But on the other hand, mostly we're seeing pretty good indications of good sockeye returns. We just had a bag limit increase on the Russian. Some of the systems down in Kodiak, the Ayakulik, seen some pretty good sockeye returns. And then right around the corner from the Ayakulik, the Karluk, which has very poor sockeye returns right now. So we're just starting to see some of these sockeye come back. So we're kind of anxiously waiting to see what those returns are going to look like this year.
So far, it's the kings that are pretty much standing out. Is there any truth to the opinion that it could be Pacific decadal oscillation?
Well, that's one theory. It's an interesting one. There could be something to it. There may not be. There's most likely a number of things out in the ocean that are affecting it. I'd be very hesitant to say that it's any one thing, and certainly couldn't say that because there isn't any research pointing to any one thing. It's also, I think, important to note that this happens fairly regularly with salmon stocks. I mean, we've gone through this before with the kings back in the, I think it's the early 90s. We had some years of low productivity, and then it kind of turns around and comes back. It's part of it is the natural cyclic nature of these fish stocks. We went through this with coho, the silver salmon, throughout South Central in, I guess it was about the mid-90s. We had several years of low productivity. Coho returns and the runs were pretty weak. We went through Board of Fish actions to reduce fisheries, and we're really concerned about it. And the last couple of years, the coho returns have been really good. So part of it's just kind of the cyclic nature of these fisheries.
So are most of the closures, though, aimed at sports fish? Is commercial fishing taking a hit as well?
Yes, there have been closures for all the fisheries. In some cases, subsistence opportunities have been reduced, too. So there have been, in most of these systems, you'd have to look at it specifically on, you know, river by river, fishery by fishery. But for the most part, the returns have been low enough that there have been restrictions to the sport and the commercial fisheries, yes. So, I mean, like I said, there's interesting theories about why we're seeing low productivities, especially with the king salmon this year. But the bottom line is we have the tools to manage for that. We monitor the systems as many as we can, and we have index streams that we monitor. And when the numbers and the returns are looking poor, we do these restrictions in order to maintain and ensure that sustainability.
Matt Miller is with the Department of Fish and Game. The Anchorage Assembly has been hearing testimony regarding a proposed anti-discrimination ordinance that would protect gays and lesbians. If passed, the ordinance would not allow for discrimination based on sexual orientation. But some Alaska businesses have already taken steps to make sure that employees will remain protected regardless. APRN's Susanna Caldwell has this report.
The Anchorage School District and Providence Hospital are two organizations that specifically state that sexual orientation is protected. In an administrative order from then-Governor Tony Knowles in 2002, the state also protects state employees from discrimination based on sexual orientation. But officially, there are no state or federal laws on the books. Eric McCallum is the owner of Arctic Wire Rope and Supply. He spoke in support of the proposed ordinance and says that promoting diversity is good for business.
This was my attempt to say, okay, well, if diversity is a good thing, how do we say it other than anecdotally? How do we measure it? And so, to me, this was the best indicator that a diverse workforce is actually makes a company extremely profitable.
Every year, McCallum's company participates in a blind study that examines similar businesses across the country. The study looks at the amount of revenue the business brings in compared to the number of employees. The higher it is, the more efficient your business.
So effectively, my company produces the same amount of sales and profit because with 13 employees that other companies across the country do with 30.
He says part of that reason is that he hires the right person for the job, regardless of sex, race, or sexual orientation.
You know, if I was only going to hire from heterosexual white males, that represents 35% of the population. If I am totally diverse and I'm willing to hire the best person for the job, now I'm opening myself up to 100% of the population to hire for a position. Why would you limit yourself to a third of the population to find the right person to fill a position?
McCallum says that he has several gay and lesbians on staff, but would not give an exact number in an effort to protect their identities. Bob Flint is an Anchorage attorney for the firm Nelson, Flint & Lombardi. His main work is in adoption, and for personal reasons, he doesn't take on cases involving same-sex couples, but refers them to other attorneys who would. He's worried that if the ordinance passed, he and other small businesses would have to take on cases they don't morally agree with.
It's not who you are. It's It's what you do, and if there is a something that you do that somebody provides a service or whatever finds objectionable, then those objections are overridden by the law, and that's what people are complaining about. So I think the addition of behavior is unique to this category, and that's where the problem comes.
University of Alaska Anchorage Director of Diversity and Compliance is Marva Watson. She says that while UAA's non-discrimination policy does not specifically protect against sexual orientation, the university does have a diversity statement. It says,
"We are united in our belief that diversity includes understanding, respecting differences in ideals, religion, gender, ethnicity, race, sexual orientation, disability, age, and our socioeconomic status."
Watson says that UAA complies with all state and federal non-discrimination laws. For the university to make any change to its non-discrimination policy, a formal resolution would have to be approved by the Board of Regents. Watson says that the university hopes to create an open campus community.
Diversity is a core part of our mission, of our strategic plan, and so we are here to create a very welcoming environment, and I think that is exactly what we're doing.
Testimony on the assembly ordinance is expected to continue over the next few weeks. Recently, former acting mayor Matt Klayman proposed a charter amendment that would allow voters to decide. However, it takes an 8-vote supermajority from the assembly to put it on the ballot. Even if the assembly hears all testimony and approves the ordinance, it could then face a possible veto from the mayor. In Anchorage, I'm Susanna Caldwell.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a messy lesson inside a king crab at summer school.
It looks like spinach stuff and like really, really gross inside.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the new AT&T, your world delivered, and by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
About 16 bus mechanics, radio technicians, and warehouse workers at Denali National Park have authorized a strike before one of the busiest holidays at the park. Larry Bell is the business manager for IBEW Local 1547 in Anchorage. He says the strike against Doyon Aramark joint venture could start as early as tomorrow. He declined to detail what each side was seeking for wages and pensions over the last 6 months. Doyon spokesman Dave Freyrich says the company believes it has offered a fair, comprehensive offer and will continue to work for a settlement that works for everyone. He says contingency plans are in place to make sure there is uninterrupted bus service if a strike occurs. Prime land in Midtown Anchorage is sitting idle due to a federal-level snafu. Plans for a new Anchorage Center for the National Archives and Records Administration are on hold, and an investigative report indicates that local developers could have doubled their money at government expense. The Federal National Archives and Records Administration bought 9 acres in Midtown Anchorage 5 years ago, and the plan was to construct a new Anchorage Archives building to relieve overcrowding in the existing records office. But the federal report questions the amount of money paid for the land. The parcel was initially zoned residential, although the developers who sold it to the federal government sought a rezoning to commercial so they could charge more money for the land. The report did not find evidence of any wrongdoing. Although the land deal and the archives plan have ties to former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, although the construction plan's future remains uncertain, one thing is for sure.
I guess you could say we've been a success story and have brought in a lot of federal records over the years, and so we rapidly filled most of this present facility up.
Bruce Parham is the director of the Anchorage National Archives facility. He says the present offices are running out of room fast.
We have records from over 60 federal agencies, the earliest date from 1867, and they go all the way through to the, you know, the end of the 20th century. We have textual records or paper records, maps, cartographic records, and they relate to all kinds of subjects. The earliest we have would be an 1862 track map of the voyage of the revenue cutter Reliance when it sailed from Vancouver Island all the way up to Kotzebue Sound.
The Anchorage facility houses records from 60 federal agencies. Its job is to provide legal custody and transference of the records to the National Archives in Washington, D.C. Parham says the local archives facility houses records vital to state history and to Alaska Natives.
We have the Alaska Village Census Rolls for over 400 villages. Starting as early as 1912, the bulk of them cover the period from 1935 to 1972. They have been used to provide proof of documentation for Alaska Natives to obtain Social Security benefits, veterans benefits, proof of date and place of birth for Alaska permanent dividend fund checks, and more.
The plan to build a new facility is now on hold since there is no money in this year's federal budget to move forward. When he was senator, Stevens pushed for money for the new archives building, but no one has taken up the effort to get the project moving. The cost of the new building is estimated to be $30 million, but the National Archives only received $1.5 million toward construction 2 years ago. The Federal National Archives paid $3.5 million for the land and so far has spent $9 million on design and site work. Parham is leaving comment on the investigative report up to federal spokespeople in Washington, D.C., who were unavailable for comment. But he says the current facility has no public parking, and that limits school groups and tourist buses from accessing the facility. The archives has material unique to Alaska, like the records of the Pribilof Island seal harvests and the collected papers of pharmaceutical magnate Sir Henry Welcome.
Firm invented Neosporin, which many of us have probably have used over time for this and that.
Welcome back to Episcopal Bishop William Duncan's trek to found New Metlakatla on Annette Island. Parham says the National Archives has been working on getting a new facility in Anchorage since 2002. That's a long wait, but there is little to be done now but wait some more, because it is up to Congress to appropriate the funds. So far, none of Alaska's congressional delegation has included an archives building in funding requests. Anchorage land developer John Rubini sold the land to the National Archives. Rubini was not available for comment. The Anchorage Police Department announced yesterday that investigations into the deaths of five homeless men during May and June show no sign of foul play. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
According to APD Public Information Officer Lieutenant David Parker, based on the autopsy results from the State Medical Examiner's Office, the five investigations are complete.
They found that three of the five incidents that they have final reports on were accidental deaths. One was considered a natural death, and the last was termed a suicide. Now, we have to be cautious with that.
Parker says regarding suicide as a manner of death, there's both intentional and unintentional. The latter might be if someone ignores a prescription warning not to drink alcohol and take a drug at the same time. Since early May, seven street people have died outdoors in Anchorage. All were men. One, originally from outside Alaska, has not been publicly identified because the department is still unable to locate any next of kin. The investigation into his death remains open, as does that of Edwin Wheeler. Formerly of Bethel, Wheeler's body was discovered outside an apartment building in Fairview in early June.
They're awaiting the return of the toxicology results before they make their final report.
The five officially completed investigations involve the deaths of Stanley Ivey, Wesley Small, Danny Wright, Joseph Ferreira, and Simeon Boots. According to Lieutenant Parker, each man had a different cause of death, although four involved alcohol.
One was drug and alcohol intoxication. Another was acute alcohol intoxication. Another, acute and chronic ethanolism. The fourth was drowning, which with contributing factors of blunt force trauma and acute ethanol ingestion. And finally, hypothermia due to environmental exposure.
The series of deaths attracted a great deal of media and public attention, not only in Anchorage and Alaska, but also outside the state. Lieutenant Parker says, in the end, though, it was not so much the nature of the deaths as the timing that proved unusual.
It's just that when we had so many in such quick succession, I think we had three within 10 days, that kind of piqued the interest of the public. The street lifestyle is a very dangerous lifestyle. We all understand that.
He says, however, should additional information become available, any of the cases could be reopened and the investigation continued. This is Len Anderson.
A group of University of Alaska Fairbanks journalism students are headed to Iraq. The trio will embed with the Fort Wainwright-based Stryker Brigade in August to report during the final weeks of the unit's deployment in Diyala Province. UAF journalism professor Brian O'Donohue, who will lead the month-long Iraq assignment, says the students will be reporting from Diyala at a key time.
It's an area that was very dangerous about 2 years ago, and right now represents one of the possible triumphs of this whole surge endeavor. At the same time, it's one of the areas that you're really going to look at to see if the insurgency is truly under control or if it's going to explode again as the U.S. forces pull out.
The students will be participating in an Army embed program that's come under criticism for controlling reporters' stories, but O'Donohue says it's a worthwhile experience for the young journalists.
There certainly has been some consternation within journalism circles as to whether or not it somehow compromises the material you're gathering. On the other hand, it's a window that you can't get any other way in this war at this time. And I'm pretty comfortable that we can work within the rules without compromising our journalistic integrity.
The Iraq trip is being paid for with a $35,000 grant from University of Alaska President Mark Hamilton. The grant taps funds donated to the university by BP.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by the UAF College of Engineering and Mines, providing early registration for fall engineering classes at 1-877-474-7390. Information at uaf.edu/cem.
Jamaican musher Newton Marshall is teaming with Lance Mackey for a run at the 2010 Iditarod. Marshall completed the Yukon Quest last winter under the tutelage of Hans Scott out of Whitehorse. Jamaican dog sled team founder and manager Danny Melville says the switch to Mackey and Fairbanks reflects the new challenge.
It's an all-Alaskan race this time. And the opportunity, you know, came up to do it with Lance. And so it's logistics. And so that was really, there was just no major issue with it.
Melville says the Iditarod project is part of a larger Jamaican team program that includes other mushers and races in Canada and the lower 48. Melville says running the Iditarod is a goal, but only a step towards the team's greater ambitions in the sport.
The Iditarod is probably the epitome, you know, the most famous of all sled dog races. But let me ask you a question. How many times has Lance Mackey run it? You know, it's not something you just do once. You try and improve your position every time, you know.
Melville says the team may turn its focus back to the Yukon Quest in 2011. Newton Marshall is guiding dry land dog tours in Jamaica this summer, but will travel to Fairbanks December 1st to begin training for the Iditarod with Mackey. He would not disclose how much it's costing to train with Mackey, except to say it isn't cheap. This summer, students are taking a hands-on look at some of the things that make Unalaska unique. This time, their hands were on and in. KUCB's Ann Hillman joined the experience.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh.
It happens.
Oh.
It happens.
Oh.
It happens.
Oh. A group of 17 summer school students gathered in Reed Brewer's lab to learn about one of Unalaska's most important subsistence and commercial species, red king crabs. Blood squirted as Brewer helped the students cut off the carapace from a large male. Together, they learned about the different parts. Reactions were mixed.
It looks like spinach stuff and, like, really, really gross inside.
One student was checking out the hepatopancreases, a soupy mixture that serves as the crab's pancreas and liver mixed together. It sits inside the body, right next to the heart. Contrastingly,
it looks sort of cute. All the little fur thingies.
A girl was looking at the two modified legs that are inside the carapace.
So they use this little modified leg to clean their gills, like a Q-tip, like you guys clean your ears. So a little different.
14-year-old DeQuayne Thomas Jenkins said cutting it open gave him a different perspective on the crab.
Well, we get to see how it feels, pretty much, because it's suffering a lot.
Nevertheless, he thought the experience was cool because he learned a lot about the crab, and it would be eaten in the end and not wasted.
It was very interesting. Very, very interesting. I didn't know the eyes were connected to the shell, to the carapace. So, yeah, I thought it'd be connected to the body. So I thought the eyes would be still on the body when we took off the carapace, but I was proved wrong.
A group of girls were surprised by the insides too.
We've seen it when we ate it, but not the real one. It's not cooked. No, not when they're not cooked.
The dissection field trip was a part of teacher Aura Beatty's attempt to educate students about their home.
I brought my class out to Crab Dissection Central because it is a part of my summer school field trip extravaganza. My goal for summer school this summer was to get my students out and about in the community doing things that they normally wouldn't do.
She's also planning on taking them on hikes, processing plant tours, radio station tours, and other trips. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN's Susanna Caldwell reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. 1-888-842-7848. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.